From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, it's the busiest time of year for tornadoes in Wisconsin. But tornadoes have already caused disasters in Oklahoma this year. We'll learn how some Wisconsinites played a role in the recovery. Then the challenges of rebuilding in Wisconsin after a tornado.
Unfortunately, many of our homes in Wisconsin were built 100 years ago, and those codes weren't in place. Putting them back together does require, if a roof blows off, we do have to follow today's code and put it back together according to that.
And a career turn for legendary musical satirist Weird Al Yankovic. We'll hear about his children's books.
I always knew that kids really responded very positively to my music, and I thought Kids Lit would be something that I'd be fairly adept at.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Glad you could be listening today. It's been almost 6 weeks since an EF5 tornado ripped through the city of Moore, Oklahoma. The tornado was more than 2 miles wide, with winds estimated at 210 miles an hour, and it killed 23 people and injured almost 400. It also destroyed hundreds of homes and businesses in the area. Since then, people in Moore have been trying to recover to cope with both the physical and emotional toll the storm has taken. Thousands of volunteers from relief agencies have been on the ground in Oklahoma since the disaster, including many from Wisconsin. Chriselle Greenwood is one of those volunteers. She works in electronic communication for the Salvation Army. Tom Tex is the Service Extension Director for the organization's Wisconsin Upper Michigan Division, which includes disaster services work. They're with us in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
How does mobilization happen? You know, a large-scale disaster like the massive tornadoes in Oklahoma takes place. How do you assess what kind of support is needed and how it goes into action?
Well, the neat part about the Salvation Army, we are an international organization. So we have folks on the ground in just about every country of the world. So when an event happens, whether it's a tornado like in Oklahoma or flooding in Milwaukee, we have folks there that are already been called upon by the local emergency management to find out what we can do. In most cases, throughout the year, we're already meeting with emergency management just to give them what the Salvation Army's response will be, what they can expect, so that when that time comes, they know that we're going to be there. We're going to be doing X, Y, and Z, and how they can access that. From there, it depends upon the local Salvation Army. As they look at, and again, when you get to the magnitudes of the Oklahoma tornadoes, they realize that, you know, this isn't going to be done with just some local volunteers. They're going to need some additional resources and assets brought in. So then they put that call out to our National Salvation Army, which then, you know, it trickles down to the various territories.
Is there, for lack of a better term, a menu of services that the Salvation Army has to offer, or do you specialize in a particular few services?
Yeah, typically the Salvation Army is called upon for the first 24 hours response of feeding and hydrating not only those that were directly affected by the tornado, but also the rescue and recovery personnel. We want to make sure that they're kept healthy and fed and hydrated is the bigger part of it during their recovery efforts and their response. Beyond that, the Salvation Army prides itself in the fact that we are a little bit of the gap filler. There are other agencies and groups that come in and say, you know, we're going to do the sheltering. Great. You guys do the sheltering. We'll maybe be part of the feeding operation of that shelter. But what are the needs in the community? Every event's different. As you get involved in it, you find out that that's being handled by a local church group or whatever it might be. So then we're going to be the gap filler to whatever those needs are.
Is there something of an art to not stepping on the toes of another agency?
Somewhat, yes. It really is. We've worked with, you know, the Red Cross and the Southern Baptist in many events around the country, and we do know, you know, who's got what strength. And we'll kind of – and they know our strengths. So we can work with them, you know, side by side because, again, there's no one agency that's going to be able to do it on their own.
Chriselle, where does your specialty come in? You are involved in the electronic communication. And so when the disaster response starts to happen, how do you kick into gear?
You know, just as important as responding comes telling our story. And so that's what I was there for, kind of to act as a reporter on behalf of the Salvation Army. I went and I went into the field each day, meaning, you know, heading out to some of those areas that were hit the hardest. And I just followed crowds. I maybe followed one of our canteen trucks, our mobile feeding units, to gather the stories and to talk about how the Army responds to these kind of disasters.
Again, that was one of our requests from our territorial headquarters is different positions that are required. And one of them was public information officer and then also a media or story writer. And knowing Chriselle and what, you know, the experience we've had with her in our office here in the Milwaukee area, I thought that would be a good fit, that she could go and be of assistance there.
How do you actually prepare volunteers to do this sort of work? I mean, training is one thing, but actually being on the ground in the aftermath of a tornado is something completely different that I would imagine does not get covered in a conference room.
The Salvation Army, we will not deploy any volunteers unless they've gone through our formal training and had some experience in disaster work here locally. You're right. We can try to prepare them in a training session of what to expect and how it will affect and those sort of things. But as I've talked to Chriselle today since she's back, you can only prepare them to a point, and then it's up to the individual.
Had you been out on disaster of this scale before?
Not of this scale. Nope, not at all. I my background is the media, and I had worked previously in a different life for local TV stations. And, you know, that's what I was bringing to the plate. I was able to share that side of the picture. I talked with Tom a lot about even just packing, where to start at. And I remember he said, you don't know where you're going to be sleeping. You might be in a tent. That I'll never forget that line. And that's when it became real that, you know, we're responding to a disaster and we have no idea what our conditions are going to be. And so there was a lot of pack your raincoat, pack your boots, pack T-shirts and jeans and hats, lots of hats. For me, with having long hair, don't forget to take your ponytail elastics. But that tent line really stood out to me. And on my way out the door, I checked my email one last time, and I had just received an updated email from the folks in Oklahoma informing me that there was a large softball tournament taking place in Oklahoma City that weekend. It was the NCAA championships. Every single hotel in the city was booked. And while they had been in hotels up to that point, they were now being kicked out. And the local folks there were able to secure a relationship with Southern Nazarene University. And we spent two nights then staying in dorm rooms. And it did rearrange my thought process in a very quick manner. I need to take a blanket. I need to take a towel. I need, you know, just some of those things because I didn't know what I was going to be walking into. And, you know, you prepare as much as you can. Then again, as Tom said, you get there and it's now it's time to you've maybe talked the talk. Now it's time to walk the walk.
Well, and I imagine for yourself, sleeping in a sleeping bag in a dorm room is one thing, but then going out to the site where, you know, so much devastation has taken place, people sleeping in emergency shelters and worse is something completely different.
That's true. You, at the end of the night, you come back and you look at that sleeping bag and it looked like a little piece of heaven to have that sleeping bag on top of a nice mattress to climb into.
How do you process a sight like you see when you, you know, you go from, I would imagine, a relatively calm, normal existence in Milwaukee to being thrown into the chaos? How did it – I mean, did it take 24 hours? Did it take the entire time you were there?
It was interesting because I walked into a team who had been on the ground already for a few days, and I flew out on Friday the 31st. My flight left at 4:45 p.m. I had a layover in Detroit, and I never got out of Detroit until noon the next day because as I sat on that layover, more storms moved into the Oklahoma area and it ended up being a new set of tornadoes that touched down. And so it was a very surreal experience to be there in the Detroit airport with all of these folks from Oklahoma who are now watching from afar and there's nothing they can do. And, you know, we ran. From there, we just hit the ground and started handing out meals as quick as we could.
I think that's probably the biggest thing is when you get there, you become immediately entrenched in what's going on, and it it's probably days later that you sit back and say, man, I didn't realize that the devastation was going to look like this. Or it could be immediately also. But I remember Ground Zero the first time I went there. They actually planned that we would be there 24 hours before we were going to be put in service. And they gave us the time to absorb and figure out where you're at and what's going on. So that was helpful for me. The other piece that's so important, the difference maybe between us and some of the other agencies there, we are a Christian organization. That spiritual aspect of it, having that foundation of God and Christ in your life is important for your well-being. It gives you that foundation to fall back onto.
When you're in a situation like that and you're helping people that have gone through this, how much do you have to look at the chaos as normal, and how much can you try to normalize the chaos or you know, take the chaos and make it less?
Well, it's important, you know, again, we have to look at it from two different viewpoints. One, us as responders, and two, as the victims or the residents that their home's now gone. This is their new normal. We have to realize that they've already dealt with a lot of things by the time we get there. And it's, you know, what have they processed and how can we help them? There's an actual transition. The first 24, 48 hours, 72 hours, they're in shock. They don't know exactly what's all happened. They can't even think logically at that point. We want to be there to help them through with that. Then there becomes a point of, oh, everybody's here to save us, to help us. And then about a week later, it's like, no, everyone's left because the media is all, you know, they've gone on to the next story. So there's this whole transition period, you know, some call it the honeymoon phases, and then others, you know, the next phase is the everyone's left us, desperate phases. We want to be there for that through all of that. The fact is the Salvation Army is still in Joplin, Missouri, 2 years after that tornado hit there. So we're going to be in, you know, Oklahoma, whether it's Moore or Oklahoma City, for a long period of time to help people transition through that. And everyone handles it differently. You know, there's certain ones that, okay, let's roll up our shirt sleeves and I'm going to get on with this. And in some ways, a tornado is a little bit of a easier disaster to handle than, for instance, a flood, because you know what you've got left after the tornado leaves. Where a flood, it's going to be weeks, months before the waters recede and you get in to clean up. But again, it's every event's a little bit different. But we want to be there to help them through that. I would think by this stage of the ball game, and, you know, Chriselle, maybe you can input into this, most of that's over with. You know, it's now been, I don't know, is it 30 days since the initial Moore, Oklahoma tornado hit? They've got to move on. You know, it's now wipe off the concrete slabs and start building.
How do you decide when it's time that you can or should leave?
You know, that's a good question. The Salvation Army will always, all of the donations that the Salvation Army receives, if it's marked, you know, for the Oklahoma tornadoes, every nickel will go to the Oklahoma tornadoes, much like Joplin or any other event. So one, I guess, is when the funds are gone. But even at that point, that's not the end-all, be-all. The Salvation Army wants to be there, and like I said, we're still in Joplin helping today, whether it's just talking to individuals or helping them get back to their new normal, whatever that might be, might look like, or if they have a need, what is it? How can we be part of that, whether it's a material item or emotional, spiritual item?
Chriselle, what are the images that are going to stay with you after, you know, after you've had a chance to process your whole time there? I mean, as you went about the business of chronicling the kinds of stuff that the Salvation Army was doing on the ground, I mean, what were the kind of lengths that you saw people going to provide help?
I think I will never forget going into Moore. Kind of like Tom said, I made a point to not go into Moore until I'd been on the ground for nearly 4 days. You'd go into Moore and it's a ghost town. A lot of it, it's just a, you know, a strip clear through the middle of town and there's nothing, completely leveled. But where you see the houses, I think for me that was a little creepier. I where I can't see a house standing, I don't have that visual of what used to be. Where I can still see a house standing and the garage door's blown off and the windows are all blown in and there's holes through the ceiling where a piece of debris has come right through the roof, that's very haunting to look back on, and I know I won't forget those images. The tornadoes that came through on the 31st were actually this specific tornado has now since been recorded as the widest tornado on recorded history, 2.6 miles wide. But that was about 20 miles west of Oklahoma City. So we went out there, and I sat with a family in the middle of a hayfield and talked with the young father who told us this was now Sunday afternoon, and we shared a chicken dinner with him, and he told us that was the first meal he'd eaten since Friday. And I'll never forget that. I'll never forget sitting with that young family, watching them. They lived in a trailer and had, you know, their trailer was turned inside out like a tin can, and the belongings of their home were strewn across this field. And watching him and seeing the desperation in his eyes is another image I'll never forget.
You know, I've always, years ago before my work with the Salvation Army, you would hear about the horrific car accident that a small child was killed in or something, and they would always say, well, we'll have counselors at the school. And I often thought, I wonder how many people actually are seeing this counselor and how many, you know, how boring of a job that would maybe be. I've got a whole different perspective of it since working with the Salvation Army and specifically in disasters, that's a very important piece, you know, whether anyone takes advantage of that or not. But mental health, you can't just stuff it down. You have to talk it out, get it out, and express yourself to help you deal with it. That's part of our concern of anyone that we send to, any of our responders, to make sure that they're okay, healthy, they're healthy too, because many times of some of the disasters years ago, we just sent them in, sent them home, and okay, they're on their own. That's dangerous, and we really have to understand that everybody is in a different place, and we want to help them get through that.
Chriselle, have you felt like you needed to talk about this since you've been back?
You know, I kept a blog, and that was very therapeutic for me to be able to vent through that outlet each night. So that was kind of my personal coping mechanism. You know, one more story I just want to quickly share is in regards to a colleague who wanted to go into more. And he says, I just wanted to see if there was any action. And same thing, at this point, it had been 2 to 3 weeks since the tornado. But he says, I wanted to see if there was anyone around, anyone I could help. And he stumbled across a woman who was trimming her shrubs. Now, mind you, this woman had no house standing, but she was out in the front yard trimming some shrubs. And so he offered to help. And she said, well, actually, I'm having a hard time reaching that spot over there. So he helped her. And then he said, is there anything else? And she said, well, if you don't mind, we could do a little bit on this other side. And so he helped to trim the other side of her bushes. And then she said, well, now, you know, we need to move the clippings out to the street. That's where they come to collect the trash. And he said at that point, he just kind of looked at her, but went ahead and picked up the clippings. He realized that he was going to have to climb over 2 or 3 piles of debris to get to the street. But for this woman, that was how she coped. And she was there still taking care of the one thing she had standing. So some of those things that you see in those stories you hear are very humbling, and it makes you come away from that a changed person.
Well, Chriselle, Tom, thank you so much for your time and for your work.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to share.
Tom Tex is the Service Extension Director for the Wisconsin Upper Michigan Division of the Salvation Army. Chriselle Greenwood is Electronic Communications Manager for the Wisconsin Upper Michigan Division. She was deployed to Oklahoma in the wake of the tornado that struck the city of Moore. You can see some of her photos and find a link to her blog from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a break now and then talk with a Wisconsin woman about the process and challenges of rebuilding following a tornado. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Like Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we spoke with two people involved in disaster recovery services for the organization, the Salvation Army. They talked about the immediate and emotional support services they provide in the wake of a disaster, such as the tornado that swept through Moore, Oklahoma in May. But for people whose homes have been destroyed or damaged by a tornado, there is also the practical question of whether and how to rebuild. It is a complex issue in a place like Wisconsin, where the housing stock is typically fairly old. Sue Schifo is a project manager at Service Master Recovery Services, which does disaster cleanup, restoration, and rebuilding services in southeastern Wisconsin. June is usually the busiest month for tornadic activity in Wisconsin, but Schifo tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce the variability in the number of tornadoes the state gets each year might cause some people to underestimate the threat they pose to lives and homes here.
I spoke with one person the other day that said, well, all these tornadoes that are hitting everywhere else, I think we're really lucky that we don't get tornadoes in Wisconsin. And I said, we do get tornadoes in Wisconsin. And that person really was confused. And I think because we don't get them often, or specifically where we live, we don't take them seriously.
Now you do, because you've actually experienced living through a tornado.
I did. And we had about a minute and a half warning, and that warning came from me noticing there was a change in weather, a change in the atmosphere, and I brought my kids inside, turned on the TV, and the weatherman had sweat rolling down his face and said, if you're in deep here, take cover now. And there was so much of a sense of urgency in his voice that I knew, and as soon as we hit the basement, you could hear the tornado, and it was rolling less than a mile away from me, straight down Highway 41, and it was horrible. Nobody got hurt. Thankfully, there was no traffic on the freeway at that time.
So certainly there is this danger here in Wisconsin from tornadoes or even severe thunderstorms. We get a lot of those here. What can that do to a home?
Thunderstorms actually come with high winds and can cause much damage to the home as well. It can take off roof shingles. It can burst out windows. It can cause a lot of rain damage, depending on sewers or downspouts, gutter systems on the home. It can cause rain to happen or water damage to happen in the basement or any other parts of the house.
Now, Sue, you work for Service Master Recovery Services, and I want to ask you, what does this organization do when a tornado does hit and unfortunately someone's home is destroyed, like we've sadly seen so much of in recent weeks?
Each case is different. Many houses are destroyed completely and have to be rebuilt from bottom up. In that case, I think the homeowner would be talking with their insurance company and make a decision on what to do about rebuilding. But many houses have just had certain parts of their homes damaged, and maybe rain has come into their house and there's been a water loss somewhere inside their home. And Service Master would come to the home. We like to make sure that we are the calm in the storm that's happening in their life and walk them through the process of maybe calling their insurance company. Maybe they've already called their insurance company and they recommended us coming out. We make an assessment of the damages, clean up the debris, dry out anything that's wet. And we're also a general contractor in that we would be able to do the rebuild if that's necessary.
How often do you get called out for tornadoes or even other disasters? I would assume, like the floods we had here several years ago, I would assume you work with homeowners in those terrible situations as well.
Absolutely. And because Service Master is a franchise company, we have the opportunity when we are in a mini cat, is what we call them, when it happens that's going to be cleaned up quickly, to call in help from neighboring states and those Service Masters, and they're able to come and help us. And we go into the homes and we try to service as many customers as possible and get them back to pre-loss condition and restore their peace of mind.
Now, obviously, as you mentioned before, Service Master comes in and you try to be the calm party in that situation. As a homeowner, I would imagine would be very distraught. In terms of the process, what is the first thing that you do? I mean, obviously you assess the damage, but then how do you start the cleanup? I mean, that's the thing I always wonder about when I see these kinds of disasters is, how do you even begin? Where do you start?
In most cases, an insurance company will be involved, and you have to determine with the insurance company what the insured has for coverage, what's going to be the next step for that person. And we measure everything. We take a look at everything. We would clean up debris. That's critical. Sort through contents with them. We have a facility at our in our facility, we have climate-controlled storage, so we're able to store contents at our facility for them.
And that really gets the ball rolling.
Yes.
Now, you also said that ServiceMaster is a general contractor as well. So if a homeowner, along with the insurance company's ruling, goes ahead to rebuild the house as it was preconditioned, as you mentioned before, are there elements of the design that you can put in to, you know, perhaps, God forbid, in the future it were to happen again, you know, to maybe minimize some of that damage?
Well, it's always recommended that you, when there's a disaster coming and a tornado is coming, that you find the safest place in your home to be. And if there's an I-beam that is placed in the home, to centralize yourself under that place and stay as far away from the edges of the home or windows of the home as possible. And if a homeowner wants to build that shelter, typically, a basement would probably be the best place to do that and set it up so that it is the safest place. It's not always appropriate to restructure an existing home in that it could be costly. If a homeowner wants to do it, it's certainly possible to do that and to build that safe place. Maybe somebody has enough room to build a safe place, like a bunker outside the home. I think the days of those fears are gone, but I think it can be done. It certainly workable. And there are many times when we're working with a contract with a homeowner that they want to make changes in their home on their own, and we work with them on that as a change order to what the insurance company is already offering.
Do you see, when you go into these homes, you know, post-disaster, do you see these elements having already been incorporated into design, especially in these areas where you do get a lot of tornadoes? Or do you think here in Wisconsin, where we don't, where people maybe don't take the threat as seriously, are those elements left out completely, you know, those kind of interior rooms, those I-beams you mentioned?
Building codes and building standards dictate that there are structural safeguards in place, hurricane clips and the way the roofs are built, the trusses are put together, that hold to certain wind damages or wind forces coming in. So in our Wisconsin Building Dwelling Code is pretty stringent as far as following the rules. Our inspectors are always out there making sure everybody is building exactly the way the codes are. Unfortunately, many of our homes in Wisconsin were built 100 years ago, and those codes weren't in place. Putting them back together does require, if a roof blows off, we do have to follow today's code and put it back together according to that.
What is it like going into one of these situations and working with a homeowner and trying to fix their home? I mean, you talked about being the calm in the storm, but does it get to you?
I am still in awe of the disaster. When I go into someone's home, my heart goes totally out to them, and I just want to put my arms around them and hug them. Professionally, I don't do that. However, I want to take care of them. I do want, and as we all do at ServiceMaster, want to be that person that walks them through the steps that has to happen to get from here to normal life again. And it does get to me. It gets to all of us. I think it would get to you if you were in that situation. But because we're trained and because we've gone through this with other people over and over and over again, we're able to take the bull by the horns and just put it all back together.
I would imagine.
Take the steps that are necessary to do that.
I would imagine that a homeowner must feel very alone and like they're the only one this has happened to. But as you're saying, this sadly happens quite often.
It does. And maybe not with a tornado, but with fires or water. Fires are devastating to people. They lose a lot of contents. They lose their belongings. They lose sometimes family members or pets. And it's very difficult to go through for them. What I have found through time and working this with people is if you keep them focused on the steps, the process that has to take place in order to get them rebuilt and restructured and cleaned back and do everything the way it has to be done. If you keep them focused and they have their tasks that they have to do, there's loss lists to write and there's selections to make. And if you keep them focused, by the time you're done with the process and everything is back together, they're feeling better. They have a lot of their peace restored.
What about the situations where a house really can't be saved? I mean, do you go into situations like that and the homeowner is like, please save my house, and there's not much house left to save?
There have been a few times when I've attended a job site that turned into a complete loss. And in that case, the insurance company steps in and does talk with the owner about what their next steps can be. If their house is a complete loss, that means most of their contents are gone as well. And they pretty much have to pull their bootstraps up and start over.
Now, you talked about going into a home, and obviously first you have to clear the debris. You have to analyze the structure to make sure that it can withstand a restoration. Mm-hmm. Would we be surprised by how much can be saved? I mean, do things sometimes look worse than they actually are?
Yes, they do. And I think when that disaster hits and you're seeing it for the first time and you're seeing your things tossed around like just a mess and walls are halfway down, and when you walk through and after the debris is cleaned out and you make your assessment and you find that the basic structure of the house is still there, I have had many homeowners say, I don't think this can be rebuilt. And most often it can't be, unless the main structure of the structure, many what a tornado can do to a home is a tornado can actually jar it off of its foundation, or it can twist it, in which case it can be saved. It's just going to take more effort and more actual building and structural repair, and probably take an engineer to be there to write the protocol as to how it has to be put back together, and we're able to do that.
Obviously, there's that uncomfortable element of the insurance company. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes fighting with an insurance company. Are most homeowners covered for these kinds of disasters here, for tornadoes, for example?
It's called an act of God, and each insurance policy is written differently. And I would always urge an owner to talk with their agents. We don't interpret insurance policies, and each insurance company writes their policies differently. And the best person to get that answer from would be the insurance agent. And I would always urge every homeowner to talk with their agent to make sure that the coverage for their home in the area that they're living is written correctly for what they need.
Where in the home, in terms of a home's design, is the safest place to go? I guess kind of based on the structure of the house. When a tornado comes, obviously understanding that we can't predict a tornado, most of the time we don't know how strong the tornado is as it's approaching us.
If you have time to get into the basement, that's the safest place to go. Under the stairway, under a table, under a desk, under an I-beam, if it's in the basement, would be the safest place to go. If you're not able to get to the basement, the center of the house, away from the windows, the further into the middle of the home that you can be, away from glass or windows, is the safest place. Many people have been saved by going into the bathtub and pulling mattresses over their heads, and they've been okay.
How do we know that our homes even have the ability to withstand such winds? Again, obviously not knowing how strong a particular tornado is going to be or exactly where they're going to hit. I mean, how do we know that being in the home is the safe place to be?
I think the honest answer is that we don't know. I think getting the lower into the ground that you can be, farther away from glass that you can be, the safer you are. We cannot get into the mind of the tornado, and Lord knows that many houses have been destroyed in different ways. Many have come up from the foundation. Many have just had roofs taken off. Wisconsin building codes are put into place in today's world to withstand many types of disasters, rains and winds, and the use of hurricane clips. And the building inspectors are out there during all types of construction today to make sure that the codes are being followed. If you're buying a new home, I would think your house is being built according to the code that's put together today. If you bought a 100-year-old home, make sure there's a root cellar.
Do those codes vary from state to state? For instance, are they different here in Wisconsin versus, say, right in the heart of Tornado Alley, for example?
Wisconsin is still using the Wisconsin Dwelling Code, and our codes are pretty stringent. However, there is a national building code, and many states have applied their code systems to that. Many of our codes are similar to what their codes are. Right now, I think each state is independent with their building codes.
Now, Service Master Recovery Services is a member of the Milwaukee chapter of the National Association of the Remodeling Industry. I want to ask, you know, are these things that the chapter talks about, disaster preparedness, making sure homeowners are kind of aware to the risks to their homes?
Actually, yes. NARI does consumer awareness seminars at their office monthly. I think they take the summer months off, but they do it during the winter. And I do believe that they've covered this particular subject on several occasions with the consumers.
Excellent. Is there anything else you would like our listeners to know about Service Master and the work that you do?
Service Master actually does care about their customers. We do follow the laws that are put into place for the industry and the remodeling industry, and we take care of our customers implicitly.
Well, Sue Schifo, thank you so much for coming in and giving us this introduction to Service Master Recovery Services. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sue Schifo is a project manager at Service Master Recovery Services, a member of Milwaukee NARI, which does disaster cleanup, restoration, and rebuilding services in southeastern Wisconsin. You'll find a link to more resources about tornadoes in Wisconsin from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one more break and then catch up with a master of song parodies who's shifting gears a bit in his career, Weird Al Yankovic, children's book author. We'll learn more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. In case you've been living under a rock for the last few decades, those are the inimitable sounds of musician and parodist Weird Al Yankovic. The top-selling comedy musician of all time, he has sold millions of albums, has many gold and platinum records to his credit, and won 3 Grammy Awards. While he parodies pop culture, he is a pop culture icon in his own right. But Yankovic is more than probably the most popular accordion player ever. In addition to his parodies and original music, Yankovic has created and starred in films, television programs, and even directed music videos. And the multi-hyphenate singer-songwriter is not stopping there. He's also a best-selling children's author. His first kid's book, When I Grow Up, was released in 2011 and features the irrepressibly creative young Billy, as well as Yankovic's signature rhymes. His newest book for children, and let's face it, their Weird Al-loving parents, is called My New Teacher and Me. He'll be signing books in the Milwaukee area tomorrow. Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce reached Yankovic by phone to talk about this latest book and his music going forward.
Well, you know, I had my my rock star dreams when I was singing into my hairbrush in the bathroom mirror, but I never really thought that I'd be making a living being Weird Al, you know. I had a number of different vocations in mind. I think when I was 4 years old, I wanted to design miniature golf courses. Then I wanted to be a fireworks maker. And then when I was about 11 or 12, I decided I was going to be a writer for Mad Magazine, which is actually pretty darn close to what I'm doing now. But along the way, I got talked out of it and went to college to get my degree in architecture, which is a very noble profession, but I decided ultimately it was not for me. And through several twists of fate, I wound up doing exactly what I love to do.
What's the lesson you want kids to take from your personal story?
The best advice that my parents ever gave me was that the only real sign of success is being able to make a living doing the thing that you love to do. So I would say, you know, try to follow your muse and see if there's some way that, you know, you can make a living out of that.
Are there things you still want to do?
Yeah, I mean, I feel very fortunate and blessed because I've been able to do virtually everything I've ever wanted to do career-wise. I've done my own TV series and a movie and lots of records and concert tours. I'd love to keep doing it and get better at it. And yeah, there's very little that I haven't at least taken a stab at yet.
Was children's book author one of the things that you had on that career bucket list?
It actually was. You know, yeah, when I first started out in the early 80s, you know, we were pitching a children's show to TV, which we eventually got to do some iteration of that on CBS in the late 90s for the Weird Al show. But I always knew that kids really responded very positively to my music, and I thought Kids Lit would be something that I'd be fairly adept at because it's in my wheelhouse, you know, being able to write rhyming text. And I've always been a huge fan of children's literature. I was weaned on Dr. Seuss books. I love Shel Silverstein, and it was a medium that I always thought that, you know, I would have some talent at, and it seems to have worked out well so far.
Did your daughter, Nina, have any impact on the books?
Well, a bit. I mean, you know, when I was first approached by HarperCollins to write a kid's book, I thought, oh, this is great. I'll have something I can read to my daughter, you know, for a bedtime story. And I think she was maybe 4 or 5 years old when I agreed to write the book, and it takes a long time for the wheels to turn in the book industry, and by the time the book actually came out, my daughter was old enough that she was reading it to me for my bedtime story.
Well, in this newest children's book, My New Teacher and Me, we find the same protagonist, Billy, from your previous book, telling what his teacher, Mr. Booth, considers to be a lot of tall tales, but Billy tries to explain that he just sees the world differently. Why is that an important message for kids to have, the idea that it's okay to see things differently?
There's a lot of kind of concepts being floated around here. I think we're stressing individuality, the concept of, you know, marching to your own drummer, the fact that it's okay to be different, the fact to speak your voice. And also the book is obviously a big celebration of imagination. So it's all of that. It's a bit of speaking up to authority as well. But, I mean, it's mostly the idea that imagination is something to be treasured.
Well, and it seems to make sense coming from, again, a man who's made his career as, quote, Weird Al. Why is that weirdness such an important element for you in expressing your creativity?
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, I took on the moniker Weird Al. I mean, at first it was just a goof, and, you know, full disclosure, the people in my dorm room in college were calling me Weird Al, so it's not a name that I came up with for myself. But ultimately, I thought that it was empowering because if I was taking it on as my own name, then, you know, I couldn't be hurt by people in the schoolyard saying, oh, what a weirdo, look at that weird guy, you know. And it's sort of my way of saying, okay, you know, I'm a little different, and that's fine. It's okay to be different.
Well, in the books, in both of the books, there's this kind of grandfather figure character who shows up briefly, but he shows Billy about imagination and kind of this going outside the lines and using his creativity. Who was key in your life to unleashing that creativity?
Oh, gosh, there's so many people. My parents, obviously, were very instrumental in developing that part of me. They gave me the freedom to basically explore my imagination. And I had a lot of relatives like that. I had aunts, and I had a wonderful grandmother who was very supportive, and a lot of friends through the years and associates. I've been very fortunate to be able to surround myself with people that nurtured that warped brain that I have.
Well, tell us about the writing process for your books. Is it the same as how you approach your songs?
It's very similar, actually. I've been writing songs for over 30 years, and I wouldn't say it comes easily, but I've had a lot of practice at it. It's fairly easy for me to be able to put a rhyme together. And doing a children's book, in a sense, is like writing a long narrative song, except that I don't have to write the music for it, obviously.
Do you sometimes find yourself, as you're writing these, starting to create a little melody in your head?
No, not really. It's more, there's a definite rhythm to it. I'm not sure the exact name. I don't think it's iambic pentameter, but there's a very set pattern that the syllables have to flow into, and they do have to flow naturally because you have to imagine, you know, parents reading this story to their kids at night, and it has to flow naturally off the tongue. So that it's very important that the syllables sound right and they flow naturally.
Is there something, too, to the fact that a lot of your fans have grown up with your music over the years, and now they have children that they can read your books to?
That's very flattering, and yeah, my fan base definitely has grown up with me. I mean, you know, I came on the scene in the early 80s, and a lot of the fans that were coming to my live shows then are still coming to my live shows, but now they're bringing their kids and, you know, sometimes their grandkids. And there are a lot of people that are very happy that I'm doing the children's books because now they can indoctrinate their children early into the world of Weird Al.
Is that a strange place for you to be in, kind of this creative outlet for families to gather around? I mean, had you ever set out to be a family comedian, a family artist?
Being a family artist was never anything that I did in any kind of calculated way. I mean, I just did what I thought was funny and amusing, and that seems to have appealed to a very wide demographic. It's very gratifying when I look out into the crowd and see the range of ages there. I mean, I really challenge you to find a rock show where you'll find a larger swath of humanity. It's really everybody from toddlers to grandparents, and they all seem to be enjoying the show on a different level, which is really wonderful.
Well, what about your music? What can we expect coming from you now that we have this second children's book out? Are you working on any new music right now?
I am. I'm about half done with the next album. I've got all the original songs done, and I have yet to conceptualize the parodies. On the road intermittently for the rest of the year, so I would sort of doubt that the new album would be coming out this year, but next year I think is a fairly good possibility.
Much in the same way you talked about how your writing style for your books is in some ways similar to that for writing your songs, is writing your original music different than the process you go through when you're writing the parodies?
It's a bit of a process in that when I'm writing the originals, I don't have a set template. I mean, with the parodies, I know exactly how the song goes, obviously, and it's a matter of, you know, it's almost like a Tetris game. Like, this line has to fit this way, you know, in order to work, and this has to rhyme with this. And it's more of a puzzle, really. And with the originals, even though a lot of times they're pastiches and I'm writing them in somebody else's style, it's really a blank slate. I can do anything that I want to, which gives me more freedom, which is not necessarily a good thing because that means there's a lot of possibilities and options. And being obsessive the way that I am, I like to explore as many options as I can. So writing the originals generally takes me, you know, twice as long, at least, as writing the parodies.
As you've been parodying music over the years, how have you seen music change?
Well, pop culture and music is always changing. It would be difficult for me to articulate exactly how, but I mean, you know, you could certainly listen to music from the last decade and the previous decade and see, well, yeah, it's different. I mean, certainly the whole auto-tune as an effect thing, which I thought was going to be a novelty and be gone very quickly, that's still prevalent in pop music. We seem to have gotten away from conventional rock instruments. In the 90s, the grunge and the garage band movement happened, and we're back to like guitars and drums, and now it's back to a lot of programming and sequencing. And again, I'm not talking about all music. There are certainly a lot of bands that are playing their own instruments, but a lot of the songs on the pop charts these days are very highly produced and to a click track, and there's not a lot of the kind of charming amateurishness that I like about some of the DIY bands.
Now, does that make it more difficult to parody when some of these songs are so highly produced, or does that actually make it easier for you?
It kind of doesn't make any difference in terms of doing the parody because, you know, I work with a very talented band, and we can emulate virtually anything. We can do everything from polka to gangster rap pretty well, so we're up for the challenge.
I mean, that is one of the most amazing things when you go to one of your shows and you see the numerous styles you guys take on, all the while putting on this really grand spectacle with all of the costume changes and everything. Have you stayed with the same band all these years?
Well, first of all, thank you so much. That's very, very sweet. And yes, I have. It's the same band. I've had the same drummer since 1980, John Bermuda Schwartz. My guitar player and bass player, Jim West and Steve Jay, have been with me since 82. And our touring keyboardist, Ruben Valtierra, has only been with us for 21 years. So he's the new guy.
Only.
Yeah.
Well, I have a couple questions from our listeners. Well, one listener asks, how does it feel to be referenced in so many sitcoms and cartoons? Do you consider yourself to be kind of this pop culture icon?
Well, that's not a good question for me to answer modestly. but it's kind of ironic that I'm this guy that's always making fun of pop culture, and now I get referenced so much in pop culture that I've, in a way, become a part of it. So it's very odd for me, but I'm very flattered by it, of course.
How often do you change your stage show, and how do you choose the costumes that you wear each show?
Well, it's pretty set from show to show because it's so theatrical and there's so many moving parts and there's so many logistics that we can't be too spontaneous from show to show because we figure out exactly how many seconds it takes to get from one costume to the next, and that's how many seconds the film clip has to be, and everything has to work like clockwork. So it's not like we can say, okay, tomorrow night let's do this song instead and let's switch this over here. That doesn't work. So basically, it's on any given tour, it's virtually the same show from night to night. But from tour to tour, of course, we mix it up and include things from whatever happens to be the new album and switch out some of the older songs and try to make it as different as possible from tour to tour.
Well, so then how do you keep it fresh each night?
You know, it's always fresh for us. As long as the audience is into it and clapping and singing along and enjoying themselves, it never gets old.
All right, and then one last question from our listener. What is your favorite piano accordion?
The one that I play on stage right now is one that I bought off of a fan. Several years ago, he came to one of my shows and wanted me to sign the accordion. I said, wow, this is like the accordion that I had when I was a kid. Can I buy it from you? And he sold it to me on the spot. So I don't know. The one I play on stage probably right now is my favorite accordion personally. I don't really have a brand of accordion that I can recommend. I think most of the nice acoustic accordions are made in Italy, but I wouldn't be able to tell you specifically what kind.
How have your fans reacted to these children's books that you've put out as a little bit of a change, a point of departure in what they maybe expect from you?
Well, they seem to be very supportive. It's not like I'm stopping doing music to do children's books. I'm doing both. So seem to be very excited about it. In fact, we sell When I Grow Up on the merch table when I do my shows, and they sell very well there. And, you know, like I said before, it's nice for them to have something to share with their kids. If they're too young to appreciate the music parodies, at least they can get a little Al in their lives.
Well, Al Yankovic, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Al Yankovic's newest kids book is called My New Teacher and Me. He is better known, of course, by his moniker Weird Al. Yankovic is a multi-platinum singer-songwriter, musician, comedian, parodist, pop culture icon, and all-around good guy. He'll be signing books at the Barnes & Noble at Brookfield Square Mall tomorrow evening. You can find more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Another one rides the bus, another one rides the bus, and another comes on, and another comes on, another one rides the bus. Before we go today, a reminder that our fiscal year is just about to end. Your gift before the end of this week will help determine the ultimate success of the past year's membership efforts at Milwaukee Public Radio. You can make an important difference today at wuwm.com/give or by calling 414-270-1225. And thanks. That is Monday's Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, how changes to the GED test are causing anxiety for some people in Milwaukee, and not just about their scores. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. Another one rides the bus. Another one rides the bus. Ow! Another one rides the bus. Hey, hey! Another one rides the bus. Hey, 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 hey.